From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Michael Paterniti first heard about the cheese when he was in grad school, a time when he couldn't afford to buy any. But that didn't really matter. It was the story of the cheese that drew him in. There was a man in a tiny village in the highlands of Castile, Spain, who had rediscovered an old family recipe for a cheese that he lovingly would make by hand and then let age in the family's ancient cave. It's great, right? Well, so's the story of the cheesemaker. His name is Ambrosio, and Paterniti says he isn't just a cheesemaker. He's the maker of the story of the cheese as well. And that's what Paterniti's new book is really about. Not just the world's greatest piece of cheese, but the stories, he says, that are designed to stop time for a little while. The book is called The Telling Room. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You'll find the real teaser for Michael Paterniti's new book in the subtitle, A Tale of Love, Betrayal, Revenge, and the World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. You've heard stories about betrayal before and revenge, but the world's greatest piece of cheese? That's the hook. It was for Paterniti when he first learned about the man in a village in the meseta of central Spain who had recovered an ancient family recipe for a cheese he would age in the family's ancient cave. Paterniti said when he traveled to Spain, he went looking for an ideal he thought existed, that there was a place where you could step out of time. But he knew it wasn't sustainable. And really, it wasn't about the cheese. It was about the story of the cheese. The book is called The Telling Room, and Michael Paterniti is joining us today to talk about it. Michael Paterniti is a correspondent for GQ magazine. His first book, Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, was published in 2001. It was a New York Times bestseller. You may have heard of it. His new book is, as I said, The Telling Room, A Tale of Love, Betrayal, Revenge, and the World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. And he's joining us today from a studio in Portland, Maine. And Michael Paterniti, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin. I sort of mentioned how you came to this story. You're a grad student at the University of Michigan. This was several years ago. You had a job of proofreading this newsletter for a local upscale deli, and then you hear about this eccentric man in Spain who's trying to keep this ancient tradition alive. What was it about that? Was it the cheese part? Was it the man part? I mean, what was it about the story that really caught you?
Yeah, that's a good question because at the time, this was way back in 1991. This deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Zingerman's, was sort of at the forefront of finding and selling artisanal products. And one of the owners, Ari Weinzweig, would travel the world and bring back these amazing, food products. He'd bring back like the best black licorice from Finland and the best sherry vinegar from Seville. And he had found this cheese, and in the newsletter, it was a little four-paragraph entry, but everything about the entry sort of suggested this fairy tale. He mentioned that this cheesemaker lived in a tiny, isolated village. His name was Ambrosio, which seemed absolutely fantastical to me, and he had it from this old family recipe. Brought back this cheese by milking his sheep, and in a little stable, he would boil the milk and stir it over a flame. And then after the cheese had been made, he would rush it up to their family cave where he would age it for a year and turn it every day and then at the end soak it in olive oil. And I remember Ari wrote in that entry, not only was it the most expensive cheese they'd ever sold at that time, and I think it was like $22 a pound, but that he'd never tasted a cheese like this. He called it rich, dense, and intense, and he was afraid to put it out in the deli for fear of, you know, riots or something. Right. But there was something just in that little entry to me that seemed sort of magical. And I remember when the newsletter was finished, I ripped it out of the finished newsletter and kind of folded it up and put it in my wallet. And then, you know, flash forward 9 years from that point, and I was a magazine journalist going to Spain on assignment to write about the great chef Ferran Adrià. And I, you know, I still had that entry in my wallet and then thought, you know, hey, what if I went up to that village on an off day just to try the cheese?
You know, you say in the book that you couldn't stop thinking about it. I wonder what was it that you – I mean, you say it occurred to you that it was partly about the time in which you lived. I mean, the early 90s when you first encountered the story. There's a recession. There's this poisonous, you know, political debate over Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas going on. And then you hear the story about this cheese, and it, I guess it seemed like a real contrast for you.
It seemed so ridiculous almost. But this idea of – and I was in grad school. I was in the writing program. I was writing fiction. And so I spent my days making stories and aging stories and concocting stories. And there was something in this image of the lonely figure up on the Castilian meseta milking his sheep and making this product that had won over sort of this small segment of foodies in the world. It just gave me this weird kind of hope, like, well, if this guy is doing it, if this guy is making this cheese and in this cheese is the story, then maybe there's something here that I can identify with, sort of the lonely figure working at a craft in hopes of eventually you know, being able to bring it to market or to at least in this case tell a story in a public way rather than a private one.
Yeah. Ambrosio Molinas is this eccentric, incredible man. Describe him, if you would. Falstaffian is one of the words you use. And you talk about how he's generous and how he loves life, and he seems really kind of not obnoxious, but loud. I mean, he certainly can speak up, right?
Yeah, he is a force. He's just an absolute hurricane of a human. He's 260 pounds, and he is literally in all my travels as a journalist is really the greatest storyteller I've ever met. And he has this sort of charismatic way of wrapping everybody into his world and into his philosophy of the world, which relies on going backwards instead of forwards and preserving these old tastes and these old products. But to be in his presence is, you know, really to be on an epic bender in every way, you know, because red wine is so central to life there that you find yourself drinking early and often. And, you know, 3 a.m. suddenly in the telling room or at the bar, he pulls out his charanga and starts singing and has everybody else singing. So he's very much the life of the party. But then there's this other more contemplative part of him. And there's also this story that he carries with him that has changed his life.
Yeah. He's also scatological, and it's hard to sort of describe this part of the book without cursing, but I do want to make a reference. He says, and I'll replace the word here, no one knows how to poop crap
right.
anymore. Yeah. But this is an important, kind of an important theme in terms of how he describes his you know, his connection to the land. Talk about that, if you would.
So he... This is central to his grand philosophy, as he puts it, and the fact that it is scatological makes it all the more important for him because he feels that we've lost touch with our animal self, the part of us that's connected to nature, that we are constantly rushing between meetings and deadlines. We're constantly on our computers and taking calls, you know, in those moments when that might otherwise be contemplative, you know, we're reachable at every single moment of the day. And we don't listen to our bodies.
Yeah.
We don't listen to the natural world. For Ambrosio, you know, the animals are talking. The wheat is talking. The wheat tells him when it's time to harvest. The grapes tell him when it's time to harvest. And he believes this. And he believes that the cheese spoke to him also, which I found at first, you know, remarkable. And then after years of returning to this little village of Guzman, you know, population 80, I realized that everybody thought this way, that there was nothing unusual about being tuned to the world in this way. And when it came to this idea of defecation, he was adamant, and he could literally go on. He could carry on for hours in the most hilarious ways about this. But finally, he was making this very important spiritual point, which was that because we've lost our ability to really taste the old foods, to really have these moments of, you know, biological function, that we've lost this spirituality. So there's something in the rawness of it and in the humor of it that I also found, for me, very inviting, because he was talking about this world that I felt like I was losing in my own deadline life and with a young family, finding less and less time to connect with my friends, to connect with the outdoors, to connect with the food that I was eating. Everything felt like an emergency, you know, and you're just putting out the next fire. So there's something so enticing when you meet somebody like this, this sort of big Zorba-esque character who wraps you in his ideas and his stories, and he makes you laugh, and he transports you, and he shows you a world that could be, which is very different from the one you're living.
Yeah. I want to ask about Guzman. This tiny village. Again, you said something like 80 people. And you describe it as having a kind of a sense of peace in some way. How do you describe that place? We have to describe Ambrosio for sure, but we also have to understand his place.
Yeah, I think the place is so magical and is so completely a part of him that the two are inseparable. But Guzman sits about a half mile above sea level on these high plains in north central Spain. And it's very much isolated. It almost like shows up on the landscape as this shipwreck. You know, it sits up on a little hill, and the church has this spire that kind of rises out of the landscape. And it looks very much like a place lost in time, and you come upon it from below. And as you come closer through the vineyards, you realize that the buildings all seem to be crumbling on themselves, and this place is sort of imploding. But there is a life there. I mean, I'd say of the 80 people there, the average age might be 80,
wow.
But there's still people who cling to this village because it's the village of their youth and of their memories. And so when you show up in this place, people are quick to greet you and show you great generosity. And for me too, that was unexpected, I think, especially in Castile. You know, I wasn't expecting that kind of openness and warmth right away. Mm. So I was greeted like the 81st citizen
right.
of Guzman, and it became very intoxicating, not just the wine, but the idea.
Well, you describe how throughout the region there are these bodegas. They're caves, essentially, ancient caves. Some date back as far as the Roman occupation of Spain. And I want to have you read a section here that describes all of this. The families would add these rooms above the caves you describe in the book, you know, for very practical reasons. But eventually they become places where families really gather to share a meal. Read this section from the book, if you would.
Sure. As all the families in the village built or inherited bodegas, these are the caves, they also added these counting rooms, sometimes sculpting a foyer and perhaps stairs that led up to a cramped, cozy space that included a fireplace. Soon, people gathered at the contador to share meals around a table and pass the time. And as the centuries unfolded, as refrigeration techniques improved and the caves came to serve a purpose less utilitarian than social, the room took on the other definition of contar, to tell. The contador then became a telling room, or a room in which stories were told. It was the place where, on cold winter nights or endless summer days, villagers traded their histories and secrets and dreams. If one had an important revelation or needed the intimate company of friends, one might head to the telling room, and over wine and chorizo, unfolding in the wonderfully digressive way of Castilian conversation, the story would out. On weekends, casual gatherings might last an entire day and night, with stories wandering from details of the recent harvest to the dramas of village life to perhaps, finally, the war stories of the past, all accompanied by copious wine. In this way, the bodega, with its telling room, became a mystical state of mind as much as a physical place. It was here where the young Ambrosio first fell under the trance of his father telling stories. Something about those stories chimed loudly inside the mind of the boy, something he could never have articulated at first, but that insisted itself over time. It was a feeling of wonder, an aliveness that came in the timeless hush and clamor of the telling room, in the presence of his father narrating stories. Young Ambrosio was transfixed. He would listen for hours and then think about the tale afterward, haunted by some weave of detail his father had spun. As garrulous as the boy was, he had the same Pavlovian response to any story being told. He would shut up and listen in a state of mesmerized joy.
Really, this is what the book is about, right? I mean, the stories. It's not just the cheese. It's the story of the cheese. I've read where you say you read and reread Don Quixote, for example. And I wanted to ask you about stories because as you say in that reading, you know, this wonderfully digressive way of Castilian conversation, They're really great at stories, I guess.
Oh, as an oral tradition, storytelling is taken to, I feel like, its highest power in Castile. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this digressive way of telling a story is really in some ways the most natural way, especially if you have time to tell a story that way, and they have nothing but time in this place. Yeah. So I think that one of the things that I was also mesmerized by was the way that Ambrosio would begin a story and then digress and tell you a fact or another story within the story, which would lead to another story, and then he would circle back and touch the original story as he was passing through to tell another. And so you have this sort of nesting of stories and these big hyperbolic kind of statements about people and the world, and suddenly he would evoke El Cid, the great knight from medieval times, the great Castilian hero. So all wrapped into one story, you had all these other stories, and oftentimes the asides and the digressions and the footnotes were telling you what the original story was really about. And so in a way, when he began to unfold these things as somebody who was a student of stories and still am, I sat in reverent silence, deconstructing as he went and trying to figure out where in the world we were headed. And that is a sensation that takes me back to, you know, maybe being a child. Maybe it takes everybody back when you're being told a story. You know, you're kind of being told that first story by your mother or father before bedtime. And I loved that feeling and was very attached to it, especially when it came to Ambrosio telling his stories in the telling room.
Yeah.
There was for me as a writer and someone who was going to make a book of this, there became later a bit of a narrative battle about who was going to own this actual story about what happened with his cheese. And this great tragedy that had befallen him, but initially it was just pure pleasure.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to that, the conflict in those stories. But in the story of the cheese, the story you say that Ambrosio could tell for hours and hours, how he rediscovers the cheese and how he loses the cheese. You describe this moment that when it came to him, the idea of, if I'm going to make my family's cheese. And it was, I mean, it's very specific. It's another section I want to have you read. There was this summer evening, and they're talking about food, he and his father. Mm-hmm. And his father was craving wine, but also something else. He wanted something else. He said maybe some cheese would be fine. And you say it was kind of at that moment that the idea entered into Ambrosio's mind, as you say, fully formed. Uh-huh. Read this section, if you would.
Sure. And I would just add one other thing. His father had some years earlier had fallen gravely ill and was near death. And Ambrosio was brought back from Madrid, where he was allegedly going to school, though he skipped school every day and went to the bar to listen to people tell stories. But Ambrosio came home to find his father, basically on his deathbed. And Ambrosio made this little vow to the heavens that if his father recovered, that he would make an offering. And so that was also playing in the back of this. So yes, let me start. Once there'd been a time when families had made their own cheese as they'd made their own wine. Ambrosio had a memory of eating his family's cheese as a child and even now could conjure its sharp tang and the images associated with it. His mother's kitchen with its gas and simmering pots of milk and the bodega shelves where it was stored. In each case surrounded by people, warmth, the past. As he understood it, the family cheese had been made for as long as there'd been a written recipe. Had been made for so long, there'd never been a written recipe. Then came the Civil War, mass killing, societal rupture, dictatorship, the hunger. The government began rationing food. People scrounged for what little could be had. Soon droves abandoned the countryside for the cities, trading field work for factory shifts, killing rural life. With less and less land and fewer hired hands, the Molinas family found its batches of cheese diminishing. Until that time in the 1950s, when Ambrosio was a boy, when they agreed to stop making it. It was another luxury they couldn't afford anymore. But standing in that twilight field with his hungry father, Ambrosio Molinas had a revelation. Why? Why had they stopped making it? Or why couldn't they make it again? That very same cheese. He had no clue how to do it, but it was something his father craved, and his father was standing here, alive and able to crave it. And here was Ambrosio, the son, breathing and alive and able to give it. And to the son's great backward-reaching brain, the fantastically impractical dream device between his two ears, the thought arrived as if by directive. There were no what-ifs or let's-sees, just that Iberian blast of confidence, the same that set Spanish galleons sailing to the New World. We will.
That's Michael Paterniti. His book is The Telling Room, a tale of love, betrayal, revenge, and the world's greatest piece of cheese. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Michael Paterniti. We're talking about his new book, The Telling Room, a tale of love, betrayal, revenge, and the world's greatest piece of cheese, joining us from a studio in Portland, Maine. So the cheese, which we'll get to how he makes it, but it catches on, and boy, does it catch on, becomes famous, this cheese. Fidel Castro is obsessed by it. Ronald Reagan is. Frank Sinatra. Said to have had magical qualities, the cheese. After you first met Ambrosio, though, I want to go back there. You write about how you returned home and you pin this photograph of him to the wall by your desk. And then you ask yourself, what is it that you saw in him? Was it, you know, was it freedom? Was it guidance? But you say you came to realize that he was kind of this link to the past. Does that go back to what you were talking about earlier, this idea that things were so fast, so urgent in your life, that this seemed something from another time, I guess?
Yeah, I very much so. I mean, when I looked at that photograph of Ambrosio, I had taken the picture of him sitting down in his cave beneath the telling room, holding an old key that would open the door to the bodega, and then he had an old tin of the cheese in his other hand. And when I looked at that picture, I saw this man from another century, from another time, and I saw someone so completely concentrated in the moment, in the place that he was living, that it was an ideal. It was something that I envied. It often stood as this, you know, very sharp counterpoint to the life I was living, which was really one sort of always on the edge of unwinding in some sort of crazy chaotic way. I think he became kind of and then also just his ability to tell a story, you know, was something that I revered and held up as sort of the highest form of art that I was in that moment appreciating. So it was something that reminded me in this all this craziness of this place that I'd been, this dream that I'd had that I was trying to get back to. And so over time and over the years, I met him first in the year 2000, but I started going back to see him as regularly as I could, and I brought my family back to live there for a while.
Yeah.
And I obviously craved and needed this other place, this other way of being. And then in this town too, this little village, as we went back and back and back, I became quite close to other people there, and there was again, many stories that came from the characters of the village. There was a man named Manuel who everybody said could fly. And nobody said this with any hint of sarcasm or a roll of any eye. It was just that Manuel could fly. Everybody knew that. You know, it was just a given. And he had a very intense experience one Easter night where he took to the air and flew 2 or 3 miles over the village. And it was a very intense story, and it took me years to unravel the specifics of that story.
Yeah.
So in a way, that picture was this portal through which I sort of traveled in my mind and led me into the book and sort of I think was pinned to the wall to inspire me to keep trying to tell my story or my version of this story.
But, you know, it's interesting because you're in kind of dicey territory once you start going back and once you start developing these relationships. And there's this thing you write in the book where you say, if I wasn't a journalist, he wouldn't have to be my subject, Ambrosio. That is, we'd never have to be anything but friends. If I wanted to be in this world, then I wouldn't have to stop and observe. I could just live it. So there's the journalist part of you, and then there's the part of you who's the friend with Ambrosio and Manuel and all of the other guys and people there in Guzman. So, I mean, this is dicey territory for you in some way, and it seems like this is a real conflict.
It became very, very complicated, and I became incredibly implicated in this blood feud of Ambrosio's with his best friend. And so it became even more complicated because I had been told the legend of this cheese and had believed it and believed in Ambrosio. But, you know, at some point I think I realized this in the back of my mind, I was going to have to do what journalists do, which was to get the other side, to listen for the other story or the other legend, and let those stories do battle and then have to mediate sort of between the two. But anytime, I think as a journalist, anytime you become that close to someone you're writing about, you know, a subject that you're writing about, you begin to run some real emotional risks, and that was part of this for me. He became part of my family, and we became part of his family. He was like my great protector there. And when I would show up in Guzman, Ambrosio would leave the fields where he was working or leave the vineyard, and he would take care of me, and he would usher me around. Part of it was he was trying to deliver the legend as he saw it and trusted that I would write it that way. And I think part of the betrayal that comes in the subtitle is what happens to maybe all journalists when they realize they're going to let down their subject, that there is an act, a small act of betrayal in the end when one writes honestly about an experience or a person's story, especially if they've been led into this very intimate world. And Ambrosio took me to this place where he revealed his darkest feelings and secrets and, you know, these murderous, vengeful feelings that he was looking to enact. And so I knew at some point, if I was going to write truthfully, that there was going to be something of a schism, or that our relationship would fall into this state of dynamic flux. And maybe that's why it took me so long to write the book.
Yeah, Ambrosio is such an amazing character in how complicated he becomes. And what's so interesting about the book is when we first meet him, we buy it. You know, we're absolutely – we believe everything he says, which I'm sure you do at least to some degree at first. But but of course, this other betrayal part of is his deep best friend, kindred spirit, Julian, who he says stole my soul. And this is, you know, another important part of the book, of course, this part where he, you know, stole the cheese as Ambrosio puts, you know, dupes him into signing away control of his company. That's that part of the story. But you also describe the early days of their relationship, Julian and Ambrosio, and how their devotion was unwavering. And then you write this. You say that the relationship was cemented by Julian's sweet attentiveness and Ambrosio's extroverted mythologizing of the relationship. And that's what he does, right? Ambrosio mythologizes things. It's hard to know if that's entirely true because he's creating a myth out of these things.
I think that is very accurate and observant, because one of the things that you realize in Ambrosio's storytelling and in some of the storytelling in Castile is that these stories are meant to lessen the pain of living in a very rough place with a very violent past that dates back through the Spanish Civil War to medieval times, to the times when human beings were first moving in this part of the world. And these stories were meant and are meant to give a sort of great pleasure and meaning to these lives that have otherwise been forgotten by time and by society, by the people who've moved away and left these little villages to fall in upon themselves. So he's the memory keeper, and the myth maker, and that is really his most important job in this village. And so when you're with him, you are part of the myth, and you are mythologized with him. And it is like the legend of El Cid or any great legend where the Arthurian knights, are constantly rising to their highest angels and living unsullied by the dark forces of the world. And this is what he brings you into. And it's like a spell. It's like a drug. You want to believe it, and you want more of it, and you need to hear it in a world that seems so otherwise complicated. And I think as a reporter, you know, during this time, I was going to places like Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay. I was in Cambodia covering the genocide trials. So there was a lot of otherwise dark material that I was working with. And when I went to Guzman, it felt like that bright Castilian sun was beaming, and this great storyteller started every session in the telling room with Once Upon a Time. And you really just fell into that childlike trance of listening to a great story.
I want to ask you about making the cheese, which becomes Ambrosio's overriding, you know, obsession, and he goes all in, like he does with a lot of things. Of course, he has that kind of character. I mean, he buys these churra sheep that you need, this Iberian breed that's really hardy. And he kind of goes through this process, this long, drawn-out process of trying to get it right. I guess I want you to explain this, if you would, Michael Paterniti, that he has – is it a formula? Is it a recipe? I mean, he's got to get back this thing that's been lost now.
Yeah. It's a taste. Yeah. It's a very specific taste. And this is one thing that the Molinas family amazes me with, is this sense of taste that they have and this sense of smell. And they maybe are extraordinary in this capacity to be able to remember certain tastes. And so Ambrosio's mission was to recover this cheese that didn't have a recipe. There was nothing written down about this cheese, but it had been passed from matriarch to matriarch in the Molinas family. He was working by taste alone, and he had the help of his mother. But with each new batch, they would gather at the bodega in the cave, and they would try it. And they would look at each other and sort of know instantly that this wasn't the right combination. Meanwhile, they were taking copious notes. They were out in the fields with the sheep and these little tiny valleys called barcos. And they would move the sheep around to different barcos. And the barcos had chamomile and other other herbs in them. And so they were very aware of what was going into the sheep and what that what that footprint was on the landscape there, what was being reflected in the milk and then what was being tasted in the cheese. So it was this very, you know, on the one hand sort of mystical and on the other hand very scientific. And Ambrosio's working knowledge of the land, of that place, and also of the methods by which cheese gets made, wine gets made, all of that is very, very well refined after years of doing this. And so he's his own sort of genius at it. And I think it took some time, but when they found after trying this one batch that they'd arrived at the cheese, it was instantaneous. They knew exactly, almost before they put it in their mouth, that they had found it.
He says, "Welcome home."
Yeah. This is part of it. The cheese is a talking character in the book because the cheese is a talking thing in his life. And so he talks to this cheese also. And yes, that is what he said to it. And he had waited a long time for this cheese to arrive.
You know, you talk about how one of the things that really caught you about Ambrosio's story at first is something that he had said years ago that you had read, where he says that the cheese stood for love. It was about love. That's how he could justify charging so much for this cheese. But you also reflect as the story plays on, as it evolves, it came to stand in for love, the cheese, but also for hate. I mean, which it's part of that deeper story. And you say the cheese carried so much metaphoric weight that really couldn't stand up under its own legend.
Yeah.
Which kind of gets us to this moment where you come to taste the cheese. And I have to say, it's like as I'm reading this, I'm wondering if I can bear reading you actually tasting it. You know, I mean, the expectations for it is it's unbelievable. It seems to me, it's like I was wincing, almost not wanting to know, because how could it live up to the expectation of the story?
Yeah, no, I was wincing before I had the great pleasure of trying it, because I didn't want to be let down in any way, because I was eating the story at that point. I was eating a piece of cheese, but I was eating history, and I was eating, as Ambrosio was always quick to point out and is quick to point out, I was eating part of him, part of his what he believes in, part of his love, his care, his attentiveness, everything that he's sort of staked his life on. And if it had come out, you know, like a bad, plastic wrap slice of Kraft American cheese, I would have been very depressed, you know. And so it was one of those moments that was completely heightened, and thank goodness the cheese didn't let me down.
Yeah. Well, I want to have you read this section.
So this is at the end of one summer when we moved to Guzman, my wife, and at that time we had two young children. A third came later. And we were invited by Ambrosio at the very end. This was September, as we were getting ready to go home. He invited us up to the telling room for a merienda, just a gathering and some food with his farmer and shepherd friends. And we came up, and they had been drinking. They were very loud and laughing very loudly and having a great time. They had us come in. They were serving deep-fried sheep ears, which are very hard to eat. And I had, of course, made it a point to try to become – I was trying to become an old Castilian, like the ones that they were. And so I made it a point to eat everything they ate and try everything that they did. And so I sat at the table trying to swallow down three or four of these things. And really felt like I was maybe on the verge of throwing up, and I was able to pretend that our daughter had a dirty diaper. So I left the telling room and recovered outside for a little while. And when I came back in, Ambrosio had his back to the door of the telling room, and my wife was standing off to the side, my wife Sarah, and she was motioning to me. She said, "Hey, come here." And I walked over, and Ambrosio had this white tin that, and this is what the cheese was packaged in, had been packaged in. He had one tin left in the cave. He had one tin left in the cave from the original batches before it had been stolen from him. And he had opened this tin. He had set it on top of the flame. The olive oil in which it was packed was bubbling and the cheese was sweating. And he stood over it sort of in this meditative state as his friends were cracking dirty jokes and laughing uproariously. And then he went to cut some of the cheese and give us a taste. And so this is as he's standing there.
Yeah.
Watching his thick fingers grip the knife and delicately work the blade, watching as the cheese gave mini slab by mini slab, I couldn't help but imagine those wedges as emblems of a lost purity. Before genetic modification, before the inundation of wind-blown spores and superspores, there was a time when the land was discrete and parceled into its own ecosystems, tucked in its own valleys and canyons, containing its own idiosyncrasies and bursts of inspiration and originality. When Ambrosio spoke of the old tastes, this is partially what he spoke of, the taste of the Meseta, or this patch of the Meseta, as it had once existed and as it coursed through the blood of the animals here and sprouted from the earth. The wheat from these fields, El Trigo, tasted different from the wheat of Burgos, 50 miles away. The grapes, Las Uvas, were hardier here than the grapes of Rioja. The lechuga, lettuce of Castile, celebrated for its succulence, was worth twice that found in the rest of Spain. Even the water of Guzman was different from the water of Roa just down the road. We need to preserve the taste of this magical place for our children, he'd once told me. Arrayed on the plate now were a dozen or so slices. Ambrosio offered the cheese to us first, and I took a piece. Then Sarah took one, our eyes meeting briefly as we mirrored flickering smiles, and together we slid them into our mouths. Yes, this was really happening. How do you begin to describe a moment for which you've waited a small eternity, thinking it was never to be? How do you downplay such a consummation? Inside, I was turning cartwheels, doing the Watusi, soft-shoeing with a vaudeville smile, while outside, my ersatz Castilian stoicism crumbled. Wow, 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 I repeated, as Ambrosio watched and grinned, saying nothing.
That's Michael Paterniti. His book is The Telling Room, a tale of love, betrayal, revenge, and the world's greatest piece of cheese. Joined us from a studio in Portland, Maine. Michael Paterniti, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The Moth and the Flame composed our theme music. Taylor Almond is our intern. Our thanks to Susan Anderson. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.